you definitely can see the way that people look at you there. And it doesn't bother me because I think that, you know, they kind of feel like we're supporting you in a way because we're giving you work. And I think a lot of people have the mentality that when you work in the trades, that when you bid a job and get the job, that you're being given something. And, you know, like I could have hired anybody, but I gave my work to you. And it's this, almost like it's like they think it's charity or something like that. And no one's ever said that to me, because if they ever did, I would explain to them that, you know, you're not giving me anything. This is a business transaction. I'm providing a service and you're paying me for it. This isn't charity. But I think that it's a classist society that we live in, and it shows in places like that when everyone drives a black Land Rover or a Mercedes or a BMW or an Audi, or it shows. It's not so much, you know, they won't say it to you, you know, they're not going to say it to you, but it's a feeling that you just get in a place like that. You don't belong there. The only reason you're there is to work. And if a guy like me ever had the money to buy a house in Tiburon, looking the way I do, it would probably really piss those people off because they would feel like I didn't belong there. So Mill Valley is a place where it's also very rich. It's kind of a fantasy land. It's this bubble. But the people in Mill Valley they try to seem like they're more down. They want you to think they're more down to earth. You know, you don't see any Black Lives Matters posters in Tiburon. None. You'll see them in Mill Valley. But the reality is that there are no black people in Mill Valley. And I mean none. They may think black lives matter, but they certainly don't want to live near any black people. And if one was walking down the street in Mill Valley at night, I guarantee you, someone would call the cops. But I'm not black, I'm white. And so I'm not discriminated against in that way. Yeah, there's this, you know, they want you to think they're down to earth until they just can't take it anymore. And then when you park in front of their house, they come out, and not everyone, but I've experienced it a few times where, you know, I'll park in front of someone's house and they'll actually come out and ask me. It's happened to me probably 4 or 5 times. They'll ask me to move my truck. I mean, I'm on a public street in a public parking spot. And when I say, well, why do you want me to move my truck? They say, because this is where I park. And, you know, I mean, that happens everywhere, but it seems to happen there more than any other place I've ever been. And again, I think it's a class issue. Like, I don't want you parking that dirty pickup truck in front of my house, not even for a few hours, not even for 8 hours. I don't want to look at it because I drive a Tesla or a BMW or a Land Rover or something. And that truck is offensive to me. And you're offensive to me because you're dirty. Because look at the way you look with your dirty clothes. I don't look like that. And I don't want people like that in my neighborhood. That's what they're saying to you. Not move your truck. What they're saying is, you don't belong here. I don't want to see you here. I know you have to be here to work down the street, at the house down the street, but I don't want to see you. So go park down the street.
This is part 2 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided.
Well, the world is big and the world is small, so there's lots of room for the short and the tall. Well, the world is big and the world is small, so there's lots of room for the short and the tall. Well, the world is far and the world is wide, but there are many different ways to see the other side. The world is far and the world is wide, but there are many different ways to see the other side. You can travel on a boat, you can travel on a boat, you can travel on a plane, you can travel on a plane, you can travel in a dance, you can travel in a dance, you can travel in a game, you can travel in a game. Travel on a bus.
My name is Rosario Villazana, and I'm the department chair of the Child Development and Family Studies Department at City College of San Francisco. Here at our child care centers, we have a toddler program and we have a preschool program. And then, of course, developmentally, children are different at each stage of development. But in general, I would say that there's a lot of the adjustment has to do with their temperament. And then, of course, there's also some cultural issues, you know, with the children who are taught to have certain parameters with adults. So all of that factors in, but I would say that developmentally, it really has to do with the way that the centers, the child caregivers, family child care providers, if that's where children are, the schools, it's how they set up the entrance and how they work with the children to acclimate them to the new environment. Children are really good at figuring out that this is a very different environment and different things are expected. But because they have these strategies that they come with from home, of course they're going to use those first. And then if they work, they'll continue to use them. And if they don't, they'll adjust to the things that are required and asked of them in a care setting. For instance, I can tell you that separation, of course, it takes a while. That separation anxiety that happens with children, it takes a while, even if it doesn't look like it. So some children come in and behave as if they're enjoying things and they're completely present, and then other children come in more slowly. They hang back a little bit. They hold on to their parents. They are reticent to get involved with other children and with the caregivers. But for all of them, there's that separation of being in unknown territory and with unknown people and trying to get parameters of who these people are and what these people expect and how they can respond to them or not. Children are very aware of things that are done differently, and so they'll refuse that just because it's so different. You know, this is not the way we do things at home. No. But they're also very flexible. So if they see that it works for them, you know, and they see that there's some advantage to them in the sense that they enjoy it, and so that's what we want to do. We want to create an inviting, provocative environment that just really invites them to come in. And so that's, I think, one of a teacher's greatest tools, actually, is to create an environment where the child walks in and they're like, I want to be here. But of course, people defer to them, you know, or support them in ways that others, their peers, are not going to do necessarily. And of course, we encourage them to support each other, but it's a different kind of support because, in a sense, there's competing needs, but they also learn how to. It's not really sharing at the very young ages yet. It's really more along the lines of we all have similar needs, not consciously, of course, just they pick this up in the environment. We all have similar needs, and the adults are going to help me navigate how to get what I need, even if what I need is exactly what the other child needs, too. And that's usually the best way to interact with children when they're having this kind of possible struggle, you know, inward struggle with their own needs and then also not getting in trouble or hurting another child or basically invading another child's space. So when we teach them by either redirecting or being there with them to help them wait their turn or engage in something else, that's really one of the best things that we can do for children to help them. Every environment, new environment that you go in has its own parameters, you know, and relationships. This is also about relationship building, of course. Boundaries between yourself and others, institutions, school and home. It's similar pathways in how you navigate that. And so the very young children, they learn, they're very good at figuring out, okay, I can do this at home, but I can't do that at school. So these are the kinds of agreements that we make, and it's part of learning the social contract, you know, learning the social agreements that we help children navigate. I don't know if the direct connection can be made immediately, but it took me a bit to come around to this. But the more children are able to play and be creative, the more flexible they are. It's when there's too many rigid do this, do that, sort of a, I don't know what you call that approach, very directive, you know, very authoritative, that children really get to resist it rather than participate in it. So the more that we can help children understand, this is just the way that we do it as a group, because this is the way it works here. And let them play with that, you know, and also have a lot of creative experiences and activities in other areas, in the activities that we set up, in the areas that we set up, the toys that we have available. Because one of the things that is a little bit, it's not focused on very much, is the role of creativity and play in helping to develop flexibility and thinking. So the more that we can allow children uninterrupted playtime, time where they're really focusing rather than us always asking them, oh, tell me what you're doing, or prompting them to talk, they are able to look at things from different directions when they play and through their creative activity. And so they see that there's more than one way of doing things. It's when we have sort of this approach of there's one right answer, or you can only do this or that, sort of black or white thinking, I guess it used to be called. It's when children aren't given options to play with things that they get very rigid. I have to get this right, and there's only one right answer. But when they have a lot of opportunities to be creative and to play, they actually develop more flexible thinking. And I'm really concerned about all the screen time, especially now, you know, with this pandemic that we really went through where we were all on screen time, you know. I'm really concerned about children's free creative thinking because we're so used to receiving things from this little, from these screens, whatever size they are, you know. But it is a great concern because children are given answers rather than opportunities to discover their own answers, you know, to discover whatever that is that they have in front of them, to play with it and manipulate it in different ways to see how many different ways they can use this tool, this toy, this whatever it is that we've given them. And it is very concerning because the more that children are in these environments where it's there's only one right answer, you know, or you have to try to get to my preconceived notion of what you want, what I want, so that I can give you the star or whatever prize they get. When that happens, unfortunately, children learn to limit themselves, and it is a lifelong impact then. Because they learn not to value their own innovative ideas, their own creativity, their own intuition, and those things, then over the years we just stop trying to insert that into whatever lesson or play or toy or even meeting that we're involved in. Competition is often something that happens much more when they're in middle school stages. When they're very young, they're much more in their bodies, you know, physical concrete stage. And so they're not so much in their heads about whether this is right or wrong. And that kind of thinking starts to happen more along the lines of 7, 8, 9 years old, and then really takes off as they get into more organized sports, actually, or activities in the classroom, you know, where somebody gets a prize for doing. And so in a way, we kind of teach it. We teach competition, right? Consciously or unconsciously, I think it's just kind of become part of our social norms. And so we teach children that one person's piece of art is nicer than the other, more acceptable, something like that. So the less that teachers do that and the less that parents do that, the more that children can be cooperative and the more that children can let go of fear of failure, basically, or this perfectionism that then a lot of us struggle with later on. So I think those are the kinds of things that would support children, you know, is to let it be much more open-ended and let them appreciate and develop empathetic responses to other children who also do well. And that's something that we can also teach, and that by just modeling it. We took out the whole empathetic, you know, because we couldn't, I don't think that as a society we could figure out how to do empathetic, compassionate education without making it moralistic. So there's that nuance that has to really be fine-tuned, I think. And we need to not be fearful of that, you know. We need to go ahead and teach children to cooperate and teach children to be empathetic and help each other rather than, you know, consider it a victory that somebody else fell in, so now I win the race. And those are the kinds of things that last for a long time. For instance, if I help somebody and I lose, then that's a message that I get from whatever environment I'm in. And so then I learn, okay, I better not help them because then I'll lose. But if we can teach children that we all win when we help each other, it's a very different mindset. So the more we focus on, you know, the basics of education, so to speak, you know, the more abstract, logical thinking, sciences, math, I'm definitely for all that. We need that. But the less we focus on the emotional development of the child and the less we focus on the social interactions and building a real community of social interactions, it's a disservice to everybody, you know, because we are complex human beings. We're not just brains. You know, we're brains and heart.
To share, to show that I care, you are my friend, and I want to be fair, fun when we share, and I'm learning now, and if you'd like, I could show you how. I'll share my toys, and we can play pretend, our toys share too, because like us, they're friends. I share my super awesome dance moves, they work better with you, and if you share yours with me, we've got something brand new.
My name is Lyndon Pinckney. I'm a writer who is currently writing a nonfiction collection called Like Flames, and I'm the editor-in-chief and founder of the literary magazine The Anna. You can get into contact with me via Instagram at Lyndon Pinckney. This piece is called In Defense of My Own Historicness, A Californian Sonata in D Minor. Part 1. When I think of who I am, the most consequential identities I claim are that I am a person who loves pink, and I'm a Californian, and I am black. These identities make me inclined to love delusion. For reasons that should not need explanation here, being a lover of pink has made me well equipped to be delusional. The footnote reads, I love a cool fuchsia pink, a pink that screams Barbie is my god, that screams I pray to the altar of the Sherman Oaks Mall, coochie coochie pink, a pink that lets you know that even though my hair is natural, I have the energy of a 40-inch Brazilian bust down, and that even my techs have vocal fry. In being a black Californian, I've learned to live in the state's contradictory identities. California is a liberal sanctuary except for in the Tenderloin and on Skid Row. Each lawn is dedicated with a tacky Love is Love and Black Lives Matter sign, when it has perfected the redlining so well that each year I drive through my old haunts and ask myself, where did all the niggas go? And where did all the niggas go? The niggas and black folks, footnote reads, they're one and the same, don't get it twisted, who created disco, techno, funk, and G-funk, who brought us linguistic hits like finna, hyphy, out of pocket, china, finna, and slaps. Where are the leisure suits, the press and curls? Where are the knees that have been caked with Crisco and dusted by the Santa Anas? I want to claim my own dignity in the face of a state whose own mythos risks swallowing me. I want to know how to switch into California's story. How do we take everyone's truths, half-truths, lies, and stories and hold space for how we are curled around one another like threads in history's throat? What does it mean for us to, as Toni Morrison said, claim ourselves as central? What does it mean to call the minor details of our life historic? I want us to be fastened like glow-in-the-dark stars on California's ceiling, illuminating the state in a golden glow. You cannot see California without seeing us. Part 2. To become a woman who writes about California, I had to lay prostrate at Joan Didion's grave. I have to wear 2 skirts, 2 jerseys, 2 leotards, 1 sweater, 2 pairs of shoes, and a pair of stockings all at once for 40 days and 40 nights. I have to lick her giant sunglasses like the sun would never rise again. I must sustain myself on almonds and Diet Coke. I have to generalize. I have to reject the South even though it's my cruel Eden. I have to forget that South Central even existed. I have to forget the Central Valley even existed, except for Sacramento. I have to forget niggas existed. I have to start using the term African American. I have to learn how to be subtle about class, so subtle that I even forget about poor white folks. I have to go to Mexico to get brown and lazy. I have to use words like brown and lazy. I have to watch Panic in Needle Park and focus on the dialogue and not on how fuckable Al Pacino was. I have to write the perfect sentence. I have to learn how to weave. I have to watch South Central burn and only talk about the weather. And even after all that, she told me on our late night Ouija board chats that I wasn't ready for such an undertaking. I have not learned how to fear the uneasiness of Los Angeles's air. Aren't you afraid of the fires and Watts, Joan asks, and I don't answer. I run home because of an auntie who lives on 3rd and Wilmington. Part 3. As a child, there are three things I knew about my mama's father. One, he was Afro-Seminole. Two, he had blue eyes. And three, he loved her very much. This, and his name was James Lockridge. On the day when my mama would give away to her emotions, she repeated these facts to me like an incantation. She never told me about his Seminoleness as a way to exotify him or bluish-eye him, but rather she was trying to stitch together a father she lost in 1974. And in return, I reminded her of her memories, validating them to her, so that she knows she was born to a man who loved her, a man named John Lockridge, who was born in Florida and lived in Palm Springs. As the years have gone on, she has told me more about him. The last time she saw him, he was being pulled down the street in a funeral procession. My mama couldn't attend because she was his secret family and could only watch from afar. She told me she doesn't believe he was in the casket, and I think she may be right. Perhaps it was a card or a single blue eye, disjointed as he was in both my and my mama's memory. I carry him with me, as we do all our ancestors, but his absence doesn't haunt me, because I'm content with the fact that my mother, whose presence is mythic, might as well have been born of woman and story. Part 4. I am a collector of stories, and I would keep them, because to me, to love is to remember. On October 9th at 2:13 p.m., my dad bought a medium orange juice from McDonald's, and I would keep a record of it because I love him. But as of late, I've been eager to share my world, and my partner has done more than his fair share of listening to me. I've missed LA more than usual, probably because San Franciscan summers are the antithesis of LA. Drab, cold, and unpredictable. It makes me feel like a child who's a picky eater. They find comfort not in the taste, but in the predictability. And in that way, I miss LA. I miss the eternally blue skies, the weather forever being 76 degrees, as if God left a forever thermostat on, and the car chases down city streets that eventually ended at the driver's mama's house, because we all know mama's house is the safe zone. Cops can't touch you there. I've never spoken so much about my childhood with someone I loved. Perhaps I think he's different. Perhaps this is me saying, look behind me at all the girls I've ever been. Love them too, like you love me now. Carry the history of me when I'm too heavy and scattered to hold. I think that, I mean, borders has always been something interesting to me just as a queer black woman, because I think that there are so many barriers in what I have access to. And as someone who now has lived in SoCal and also lives in Northern California, thinking about the body and location and the borders of those two and how like they manifest differently have always just really been of interest to me. Like the border of self within like your own internal identity, as well as if you are sort of your own nation, how does that then change? How do you gain more freedoms, or how are you able to express yourself more when you move to a different physical location? and how are we just extensions of that land and the borderlessness of that as well. It's always been something I've been digging into in my writing.
Yeah, we talked about that before, about identity and how people, when they choose an identity, it empowers them. But on the other hand, other people might see it as a barrier.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why it took me a long time to even claim my sexuality, because it felt like to put that into a certain type of box was maybe limiting to who I was. But I find that border kind of comforting. It reminds me of August Wilson and how in the play Fences, he was like, we keep things out with fences, but we also keep things in, and how to sort of focus on the positives of borders and identification as well.
Yeah, I find that limiting to be somehow also about safety. And so that's interesting that I feel like I need that. But sometimes if I say, this is what I am, then yeah, it kind of reminds me of what you were just saying. But at work, I used to say, I'm a lesbian.
Right.
And I was like, inside of me, there's a lot of nuance to that. But I didn't want other people to feel like that nuance was an opening. And so I would just be like, lesbian, you know? And that boundary was really helpful for me. What you said, it kind of captures so much about the program that I almost feel like it belongs at the beginning of every show.
Thank you for listening to part two of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujane Asale. Music by Jamie Branch, Erwin Helfer, The Doors, Tamika Reed, Ella Jenkins, Sesame Street, and Castleberry and Dupre. Margot Breyer read an excerpt from Margaret Atwood's The Martians Claim Canada. Jeff Shepard and Tara Vadri read Mending Wall by Robert Frost. We want to thank Shelley Romalis, Zachary Reese, Rosario Villasana, and London Pinckney for their willingness to be part of this program. This show was produced by Mary Salome and Emily Charles, a Queer in Your Ear production.
one more time.